Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Alex Thompson. He's a presenter on the UK Column programme, which is an alternative news show which comes from Plymouth. Challenging the mainstream press and most definitely challenging the government and its foreign policy. He's an ex-GCHQ officer, so we'll be talking to him about the privatisation of signals intelligence here in Britain and in the United States. Also, what he makes of the Edward Snowden revelations. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Alex Thompson, and for a couple of years now, I have been appearing every week on UK Column News as effectively the Europe correspondent and correspondent on constitutional affairs. I'm nearly 40, I live in the Netherlands, and I was a GCHQ officer for the first 8 years of my career after a year in the former Soviet Union. So from ages 22 to 30, I was on one of the former Soviet Union desks at GCHQ, which is Britain's equivalent of NSA, the Signals Intelligence Agency for Britain, subordinate to the Foreign Office. And then aged 30, I moved to the Netherlands, not least because I was becoming increasingly disaffected with British foreign policy and intelligence and the way that it was serving the wrong ends. And since I've been in the Netherlands, I've been a freelance interpreter and translator for most of the time. And it was during the early years here in the Netherlands that I volunteered myself to Brian Gerrish, the co-editor of UK Column News, first in the background and later as a commentator, speaker and writer on themes of high concern, particularly the encroaching police state, which is EU-wide and worldwide, and themes of globalism as seen in Dutch and other continental politics as much as it is in Britain.
Okay, so GCHQ, that's in Cheltenham. The old donut used to be Bletchley Park, which kind of moved there after the Second World War. One of the things that it's 10 years since you were there, Alex, but it's been happening for a long time, hasn't it, that a lot of the functions of GCHQ are now partly outsourced to private industry. There are quite a lot of private companies which are doing signals intelligence and surveillance of various sorts. So can you tell us what you know about that? Because that's obviously, it's another distance from the Foreign Office, so it's another kind of layer of deniability. So is there any substantial dealings between GCHQ and the private sector?
There are, and NSA in the United States is even more so because they have more contractors working for them than regular civil servants in the NSA model, that is. GCHQ, of course, overlaps very closely indeed with NSA and the three other Anglo-Saxon signals intelligence agencies in a Five Eyes agreement. So much of what I say depends on an American pool as well. But yes, to keep it specific to Britain, there are increasing partnerships, as they are often called, between GCHQ and private companies. This process is very dismaying. And through the Cold War, GCHQ did everything in-house, developing its own software and kit. But through the 90s, particularly, I think, after the departure of the last really good and patriotic and unquestionable director of GCHQ, who was Sir David Omand, O-M-A-N-D, since that time, there has been increasing evidence of third way or third sectorism creeping in and public-private partnerships. Under the name of PFI, Private Finance Initiative, GCHQ was actually the largest of these flagship Blair policy items of a public-private partnership, because the donut itself, the building, was built and is still occupied and operated, by a consortium of private operators, including notoriously Carillion, who've just gone bankrupt. But Group 4, also a local company, the boss used to live up the road from Cheltenham at Winchcombe, was heavily involved because Group 4, under a consortium named GSL, run most of the building services, the security, the staff facilities, the computing, and there's various other people involved in that. But that's really something that the staff above all see. In terms of the actual work of GCHQ, it is, strictly speaking, contrary to the whole slew of acts of Parliament that have gone been enacted along the years, for anyone other than GCHQ as an arm of Her Majesty's government to be doing signals intelligence, electronic intelligence this is these days mostly. But in practice, it does seem that contractors are getting a foot in the door. You also see the same carousel, the revolving door that you see in other branches of government, where people develop a skill on Her Majesty's tax-paid money and then go private and get hired to do the same job for more money. And then come back in the door, as it were. So it is a very worrying process. And also the techniques of signals intelligence pioneered at GCHQ, because that's where the mathematical and technical and linguistic brains are and the software skills, these are being spun out, as we have seen local councils and police forces become increasingly Orwellian for years. A famous case being East Lothian, a Scottish local authority, which openly advertised for its staff to be able to spy on Facebook posts. This strays into legally regulated territory, but the councils feel, under Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act and its amendments and successions, that they're able to do that. So by hook and by crook, what used to be unquestionably GCHQ as central government's competences have been spun out to private contractors and third-rate, shall we say, pseudo-spooks in local government.
There is a real serious problem with private contractors working in this area, and that is that they're not necessarily devoted to one master. Because of the basics of the way private businesses work, if someone comes along and offers them a contract, then they may well take that. Also, companies like Carillion, we now know, and in fact, I believe, although it hasn't been reported yet, just about a month ago or so, one of their senior managers, Terry Matheson, M-A-T-H-E-S-T-O-N, Matheson, has been arrested and is now on trial for falsifying invoices around allegedly 140% added to the value of each invoice, which he was then falsifying and putting through. So in other words, that on the books of Carillion, it was looking as if an extra 40% of all of the costs of the company, which of course, if it's true, would be fraudulent. And we'll see how that court case goes. And Carillion were involved in the Abbey Wood Ministry of Defence procurement contract as well. So this whole concept of having potentially criminal companies and individuals involved with military contracting, has there been any attempt to do anything about that, to your knowledge, Alex?
It was actively suppressed that we should talk about this during my decade, the noughties, at GCHQ. It was, obviously, you've got several thousand highly intelligent and cynical people from different professional walks of life in the same building and on the same staff networks, even if they're at different physical locations. So you can imagine the staff news groups and staff forums online were, in a secure classified system, this is, were buzzing with this kind of talk. But it was actively dissuaded. We were told regularly from the kind of HR world at GCHQ, you mustn't question the patriotism of people who've come in sideways. You mustn't question the commitment of contractors vis-a-vis regularly hired staff who've gone through the Her Majesty's government recruitment and loyalty process, as it were. And increasingly, we get foreign intrigue coming into this as well. Huawei, well known, of course, for its dinky mobile phones now, but it wasn't a decade ago. It's still majority owned by the People's Liberation Army, the communist Chinese totalitarian military government. And they supplied the new version of our secure internal telephony sometime around 2007, if I remember correctly. And this caused a great to-do. But, of course, the side of GCHQ that advises on technical security, which in those days was called CESG, the Communications Electronic Security Group, but has now spun off to London and has the Gucci new name of the National National Cybersecurity Centre, NCSC, not to be confused with the NCTC. That arm of GCHQ cracked down on our questions, saying BT and the government have examined this and found that there's nothing to worry about. So there was a repetitive theme through the 2000s of staff who were mostly not that political or certainly not awake in terms of seeing the full gamut of corporate involvement and banking involvement in government, but many of them were asking what's going on here, because you would have to be blind to miss these signs during the Blair and Brown era. But they were told not to raise this, and of course most British civil servants put their head down and keep doing as they're told to pay the mortgage off. In fact, I had some colleagues who actually said to me, I have to pay the mortgage, otherwise I wouldn't be carrying on doing this job and biting my lip.
You mentioned banking and government there. That's not necessarily two organisations that sit well together, banking being all about making profit and secrecy, whereas government is supposed to be looking after its population, including some of the most vulnerable in society.
This is very true. It was when I was a child and watching BBC News growing up that I realised that the encroachment of banking into government, Tony Benn, not of my political persuasion, but a very honest, patriotic and far-sighted man, was talking about this in the 80s, how the stock market was being held up in the news and by the government as almost the perfect mirror of society and the way that society should be going, which it had never been before. The city kind of encroaching increasingly into public life and putting its men in key positions and making its paradigms the ones that public service should also follow. There's been a lot of that. You saw it in GCHQ in terms of banking style performance related pay, which is a bit of a nonsense for public service. It's a different ethos completely. So we have seen a lot of this going on through the years, yes.
And what about 2013? Because this is when we saw the emergence, funnily enough, during the four-day Bilderberg conference at Watford, the emergence of a character called Edward Snowden, and him being a whistleblower from the National Security Agency in the US, he revealed various things which I suppose we'd now look back and say, you know, before that, people who talked about this kind of thing were labelled as conspiracy nuts.
This is true. I don't really have any detailed comment on Snowden's papers because I don't want to cross the line of talking about things that are covered by the Official Secrets Act. I have this kind of odd reservation about doing so, although I know that it's all out there in the public domain. All I'll say is he did so after careful consideration. There's a long tradition now of whistleblowers, particularly in the signals intelligence agencies, both NSA and GCHQ, going public after getting nowhere internally, partly because of the things we've just been discussing, Tony, the increasing corporatism and bankingness of government and the intelligence agencies, the encroachment of contractors, the blurred lines and the culture of not even speaking internally about these things, not airing these issues.
I mean, surely at GCHQ, I mean, it's normal. Secrecy is normal. You're working for the Secret Services.
Secrecy towards the outside world, yes. But the whole time I was at GCHQ, with the building of this open plan donut in particular, I now have other views about that building. I think it symbolizes an encroachment of banking ideas and the all-seeing eye and the like. But we were being told that we needed to be more like a management consultancy and have knowledge sharing and a buzz around our work and sharing maximally within classification permissions, so that only in certain need-to-know areas was there firewalls. So that was the theory of it. The practice is, if you raised even basic questions about who is loyal to what and whether we're doing things as well as we used to or as well as we should, you were told, well, we don't want to be taking the discussion that way. An inner core of politicized people was clearly taking over, as in the rest of the civil service. And my colleague Brian Gerrish has explained the main, as better than anyone else has explained the main mechanism through which this has happened in the civil service, which is the political charity Common Purpose. They are really the new sacerdotal caste in the public sector, and they tell us really where we have to shut up and where we're allowed to speak. So that's where the secrecy is coming in. It's very good of you to mention, Tony, that banking and secrecy go together almost more than government and secrecy do, because indeed I had some of my old Cambridge university friends going into the City of London when I went into intelligence, and the procedures they described to me for securing documents and having a need-to-know basis of discussion at work were actually even stricter, a lot more strict, in city banks than they ever have been in intelligence agencies. Perhaps I would venture to say because more money is at stake there.
Now, look, Alex, I can't let your comment about all-seeing eyes and the architecture of the donut in Cheltenham go past. Can you just explain what you mean by that?
Well, GCHQ had been housed in a post-war series of buildings which had closed spurs to them. So you had a separate lock for each office wing of 100 people or so. And in some areas, even tighter than that, you had individual offices by default in some areas, which is also practical because if you're doing transcribing linguistic material or doing mathematical deep work, then you do need a room of your own. But we were moved into this building in 2004, which has become known as the Donut, this large, round, or torus-shaped building on the edge of Cheltenham, because we were told that the facilities were out of date, which I suppose they were, and because we needed a larger premises post-9/11, which is about the time that the decision was taken to move us. But there was great dissatisfaction with the new building. The manning of all the facilities by a consortium that charged full whack and overpriced some of the services was one aspect of that. The deliberate failure to build enough car parking spaces as another. That was because of Gloucestershire County Council telling the GCHQ that we needed to be a flagship success of the Blair government's green policy schemes. All these things added up to frustrate the staff immensely, really. You could say that it's civil servants whinging, but the facilities were almost deliberately under-engineered for us. And the director who announced the move to the Donut, but who signally did not actually hang on to see us into the Donut, he went off to be the governor of Gibraltar instead, left a sour taste in our mouth, because as well as being very heavy-handed and arrogant and refusing to accept that staff were disgruntled by these small but important practical matters, he actually said in a staff circular once that it is our problem, not yours, to ensure that you can get to work and that you have a space for your park to park your car and to sit at and work when you get to work. And that, of course, failed. There was no success in that regard. So that there were elementary failures, really, to provide for the staff.
There was also a very peculiar incident with a cryptographer. This is a fascinating profession, actually, cryptography. The idea that you can make something an uncrackable code, which apparently it is possible, although many of us believe now, I think, even when we're told that our communications are secure, they're not. Tell us how, you know, for example, something like WhatsApp, we're told, well, it's actually secure end-to-end. In fact, it's sold on that basis. And yet, I mean, it doesn't take a lot to work out that if someone is actually logging all the keystrokes you're making on your phone or on your computer, then, of course, that isn't secure. So is there such a thing as secure communications?
Secure communications is a pipe dream. There has been an increasing amount of intrigue in the post-Cold War decades in which NSA and GCHQ, or the cells within them that arrange these special accesses, as they're called, and special sources, go straight to the telecoms providers, claiming that they have legal power to force the telecoms to do this, which is dubious, and saying, you must provide us with source codes. This is the software route. But there is, as you very aptly observed, Tony, always the hardware route of logging keystrokes, whether it's a phone or a computer. And all these close access techniques are notoriously or notably not spoken about much when the capabilities of intelligence agencies are discussed, even among cleared people, such as the intelligence committees of the various houses of parliament.
Oh, my God. I mean, that's a frightening prospect, that even at the very top level of supervision and oversight, that these things are brushed under the carpet.
Well, the intelligence and security agencies will not answer questions that they are not asked or not asked in the proper way. And the vast majority of cleared people internally in NSA and GCHQ and the Canadian, Australian and New Zealand partner agencies as well, they are not privy to how information arrives at their desks. They are told this is special access, particularly if it's from domestic sources. If it's done by old-fashioned hacking into communications internationally, well, that's less surprising, either to us or to foreign countries. It's taken as a given, so that is less hush-hush internally. But if there are special deals made with telecoms or even hardware producers of equipment to get information at source and package it neatly and send it to Cheltenham or to Baltimore for NSA, then that is less discussed, shall we say, even and I wasn't aware of such details, but a surprising amount of good information does end up at your desk as an intelligence officer, let's put it that way.
Do you think people have a right to secure communication?
This is really a philosophical question in the end. I think that they have, let's use that weasel adjective again, they have a reasonable expectation to privacy. When you're talking expectations and rights, you have to make a good distinction between absolute entitlements and immunities, which are really constitutional, and reasonable expectations, which gets into the realm of jurisprudence, what a judge and a jury feel on the day. Communications, really, to break into them, people know that it happens these days. People will usually accept that it's necessary for the prevention and detection of terrorism and serious crime, which is indeed the terms of reference used in the laws in Britain and most other Western countries. But when it becomes a mass scale and indiscriminate, then that is the problem. And this is what a series of whistleblowers have said from the technical parts of all of the signals intelligence agencies recently, notably Bill Binney, who was the senior technical man at NSA around 9/11. He's pointed this out, and he has more ground to stand on than others because he specifically designed a targeted tool able to pick up terrorism and other serious crime called Thin Thread, which was deliberately put aside so that mass surveillance could be put in instead in this crucial period around 9/11. So it's now been worked out by him and others, such as American Intelligence Media, who have the site aimfortruth.net, I think it is. That's a number four in there. It's been worked out by these people collaborating, putting their heads together, that actually a cabal took over NSA around 2000 and decided specifically to go, deliberately to go for mass surveillance when there would have been more surgical and precise techniques already available.
Now, the worrying thing about that, of course, is that, well, it's all very well, whether it's in the hands of honest, decent people, but when such a system is taken over, I mean, let's not forget Adolf Hitler came to power through democratic elections, and if a despotic power takes over such a system, it really is curtains for any kinds of civil liberties when you've got mass effectively profiling the entire population. Is that something that actually is just paranoia, or should we really be concerned about that sort of thing?
We should very much be concerned about that kind of thing, because there's a surprising amount of continuity between yesterday's totalitarian regimes and today's Western countries. You'll know of several aspects of this. I think the heavy industry side, that's well known because you have Anthony Sutton's books talking about Wall Street and the rise of both Hitler and Bolshevism. He has two books entitled that respectively. What's perhaps less well known is that the techniques of signals intelligence, particularly shaping public opinion and tracking dissent, that has gone pretty seamlessly from the Nazi signals intelligence agency, about which very little is spoken and known because they successfully hid or destroyed all their records, the agency called the Forschungsamt, literally the research bureau, that knowledge was part of what was exfiltrated out of Nazi Germany when it was defeated. And it went not directly into NSA, but into the RAND Corporation and the MITRE Corporation, which, of course, the latter particularly, became direct contractors to NSA, holding all the data. So the knowledge has gone by means of these corporations, which, you know, are in the same network as IG Farben and all the people the corporations people will know about if they know about this end of Second World War period. That knowledge has gone into those corporations instead. Rather, a lot was given away by former GCHQ officer Gordon Welchman with a CH, in the Hut 6 story. But you need to get hold of the original hardback 1982 edition of the Hut 6 story to find the unredacted chapter, later taken out in horror by the censors, which goes up to the 1970s and talks about how Nazi and Soviet totalitarian techniques, particularly in his case Nazi, were lifted from Nazi Germany and put into Western intelligence, basically. But intelligence is too general. It's corporate intelligence is where it's ended up.
What is corporate intelligence?
Corporate intelligence is a group of chaps running very serious banks, who have non-executive directorships on these banks, who also may belong to Luciferian and other nefarious societies who have ideological commitments to world government, population reduction, and all the other list of horrors, who happen also in their day jobs to sit in intelligence agencies or governments or wherever. And these chaps getting together and saying, we want visibility of the majority of what the world is saying, thinking and discussing.
This is idea of total information awareness.
Yes, I actually sat at NSA in 2004 as a guest at the initial annual conference, which I think they're still running, on analysis, run by NSA for signals intelligence officers from the Five Eyes countries. And one of the speakers that year, alongside General Mike Hayden, the then director of NSA, since notorious, was none other than Admiral John Poindexter, notorious from the Iran-Contra era. I'm sure a name familiar to you as well. He was the man who dreamt up total information awareness. And he was there unapologetically in 2004. Well, he did go a bit red-faced talking about it because, of course, there'd been so much negative press coverage. But there he was selling it to a younger generation of mostly officers who'd never heard of it before. I had. And saying, well, there's nothing to worry about. It's a perfectly reasonable thing to strive for. But he was very much an example to me, an embodiment of how corporate intelligence lords it over the official networks and the official government's circles of intelligence. The latter are constrained by the law and by morality and are answerable to the public and to intelligence committees in parliaments. The former are not.
Now, you're painting quite a frightening picture, actually, of these agencies potentially, anyway, getting out of control. I know you've just been at a conference. You've been giving a speech called Inventors of Evil Things. And I'm sure that will be available as a DVD or online at some point in the near future. But can you just tell us why you chose that title? What were you speaking about?
I was speaking about the long history of cabals and cartels in Western and world government and affairs. The title comes from Romans chapter 1, verse 30, and I think it neatly encapsulates the wickedness of the small groups that have always dominated anything that makes money and also have dominated government for a very long time, and how the models have been spun out from the ancient Near East through the continent, through via Northern Italy originally, through into the dominant Anglo-American paradigm we have now, with some French hangers-on. It was at Alternative View 9, which is near Milton Keynes, an annual event organised by Ian R. Crane, who cooperates closely with UK Column. And yes, I think the target date is 21st of June that the DVDs should be out. They tend to try to recoup their costs for nearly a full year after each Alternative View conference by having just the DVDs, and then eventually they go online on the Alternative View channel on YouTube for as long as we're allowed still to have that. But I was there as really the historical speaker in a whole themed conference over the weekend, which was about humanity on the cusp. Is humanity on the verge of something very exciting or very terrible, was the main thesis that the speakers were all addressing from their various angles. And we all agreed that we are indeed on the cusp. We can't go on much longer without in this way, without falling into a total anti-human tyranny or indeed breaking out of it.
But surely there are powers around the world, notably the Russians, who don't seem to wish to play ball with people like the G7, the Western countries who've been intervening in places like Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Libya, disastrously, and now attempting to still in Syria. So where do you see this so-called tyranny? I mean, do you see there being any kind of challenge to it, like Russia, for example?
Geographically, Russia is the largest source of the challenge to it. We have to step back a bit from talking about the Russians, because it's not a Kremlin-run country to anything like the extent people assume. President Putin is constrained by law and expectation and the law of the possible, as much as any other political leader is. There are factions within the Russian Ministry of Defense and the Kremlin and other power agencies, which believe that they should be planning for total war. Some of them even, I think, particularly on the Eurasianist philosophical end of the scale, believe that Russia should forge a really strategic alliance with China, and in some versions also Israel, or the Zionist version of what Israel is, in order to make Eurasia the dominant power in the world, particularly economically and also militarily. But that is not the thinking that has the ear of President Putin and the other policymakers, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, for example. there is a significant amount of resistance to Anglo-Saxon monopoly in Russia. It's the Russians who have, in the fantastic diplomacy they have been practicing since Putin came to power, thanks to Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, the Russians have been talking about the need to break away from a monopolar post-Cold War world to a multipolar world. There are increasing numbers of people in Western Europe, Germany in particular, who are equally unpersuaded. Some very serious German former senior politicians, like Willy Wimmer, who used to be the number two of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and also used to be the Bundestag rapporteur on defense, have been talking about the need to break completely away from the tyranny of the Anglo-Saxon dominant model, which they don't describe ethnically. It's just where the banks are based, really. Others in Germany as well have been saying this at quite a high level. So that by Western European standards, I think the Germans are in the lead at actually wanting to put paid to this bankrupt model of cabal government that we have.
But you said your talk was about, it was a historical talk. So what is it about history that you think points to the present day being a particularly contentious and pivotal?
History is really a very controversial thing at the moment. It has been attacked mercilessly in schools, the way it has been taught for 50 years now. John Taylor Gatto, G-A-T-T-O, describes this in his books very well. History teaching and the teaching of all subjects has been remodeled to please the tax-exempt foundations, American-based and corporatist, but really global rather than American in loyalties. We hear just this week that, according to Demos, the very dubious think tank that steers much of our public life, that it is dangerously nostalgic to be interested in the way things always used to be, that this is exclusionary and we should have less of it. History is clearly dangerous, and not for nothing did Orwell describe it being rewritten when tyranny gains the upper hand, because that always does happen.
Anything you can point to specifically as interesting points of history that we should get to know, get to understand, to throw light on the present world?
Well, I suppose it's all described in the talk I've given, but it's really the understanding of the cyclical nature of history that's most important. And you can talk about this on many levels, but just in terms of human society, there have been many times in the past when, even down to quite fine detail, the commercial model of the current cabal has been practiced and has gone through its whole life cycle. The late Roman Republic and the very serious struggling that went on between Octavian and Mark Antony in the period of around 44 to 31 BC is one where you see this whole model spun out. It was always taught very dryly at schools when people even learned any classical history, as if it were a clash of personalities. But of course, personalities stand for certain philosophies, how you carve up the world, how you gain dominance over certain raw materials, how you set the currency and how you fiddle the rate of the currency. Then this went on through the Middle Ages as well. Webster Tarpley is a very good book, again, more perhaps socialistic in mindset than I would be, but I can't fault his information. He's an American who writes about the Venetian black nobility, where certain families who become part of the bloodlines of Europe's royal families arrive in Venice, ultimately from the Levant, from the Near East, in the 13th century, the most famous ones being the Guelphs, which is just a version of the word for wolf, not a very nice surname to have, is it, and the Ghibellines and the Cabots, who later become famous as the leading lights of Boston. These families from Genoa and Venice really import the ancient Near East cabal models based on control of the money supply, monetary policy being at the root of all this, and they force it forward into Central and Northern Europe as that part of the world becomes dominant in the world economy. So there has been much prior practice of the cabal methods that are now being seen running particularly the City of London and Wall Street.
I'd like to ask you a bit about the English Civil War, because I'm constantly reminded, well, the research I do, just how important it was in terms of creating mass urbanisation in Britain, the Industrial Revolution here, and the Empire. And I wonder what you make of whether that was something quite unique and interesting that happened there, what the English Civil War was really all about, and if there is really still any clout that Britain has in the world today, and could it be used in a positive way rather than negative, as obviously most of the empire was. So what are your thoughts on the English Civil War?
Yes, I've heard you discussing it previously, Tony, and been very, very impressed that you have correctly identified it as a seminal moment, because, again, it's deliberately not taught well, if at all, these days. It's seminal because all the aspects of society come together in it: the religious, the philosophical, the economic, the sociological, the geographical. All of these come into a great big melting pot in the what we should technically call the Civil Wars, because there were three kingdoms in these islands in those days. Well, there still are, but in those days they had their own crowns and parliaments. And really, in each of the three realms, England, Scotland and Ireland, there was a mercantilist class rising to dominance in the 17th century. And I'm not a Marxist. I don't believe in class theory as such. But that aside, you do have the displacement in the mid-17th century. You see it on the continent as well, but it took a more protracted and less determined form. It was crystallized well in the British Isles. You've got the mercantilist urban classes. You know, that these are not the honest tradesmen. These are the gentlemen who get together in guilds and stitch up the whole economy and don't have the noblesse oblige of the previous aristocracy. They get together and decide that the old guys have had their day, that the landed gentry aren't going to run the show anymore. And it's them who start clearing the undesirables off the streets as the Stuart era progresses, confining the new institutions, criminalizing poverty and begging, moralizing in society. It was a very Christian era. I myself am a committed Christian and a professional theological translator, so I'm quite au fait with the theological debates of the time and how biblical morality in the best sense was actually being fostered by a lot of the key players, the Puritans. But there was a lot of fiddling going on as well. People were being told, now you're good, respectable, middle-class tradesmen. We expect you, as along with your newfound Protestantism and earnestness, that you'll also go along with these attempts to clear people off the land, basically what was done to the natives in different parts of the world shortly thereafter. Under the British Empire, which of course was nakedly commercialist and corporatist in its first century, especially in the guise of the British East India Corporation. There wasn't even an official British Empire at a government level. It was corporate. All these seeds are indeed sown in the 17th century, the key lesson which has been forgotten. And there's great variety in this, of course, because depending on which church background or none you have, which political party you belong to, you view the Civil War in very different ways. Whether you're Scots or English or Welsh or Irish makes a huge difference as well. But the key issue is that we had two wars of aggression launched against us by the Crown that only exists to embody us in the first place, this being four centuries and more after Magna Carta. And I am increasingly sceptical about the Cromwellians in many ways, but I think that when it comes down to brass tacks, you have to say that the Cromwellians were justified in prosecuting and arguably also beheading the king after he had for the second time launched a war of aggression on his own people and their political representation. That lesson has been forgotten. I am jolly glad that we didn't end there. We didn't end up with a unicameral Republican England, because that would have been a disaster in the longer run. And it was, even in the short years of Cromwell and the Protectorate after him with his very weak son. But I don't think the Restoration in the Stuart era was the great success either, nor indeed the Glorious Revolution under William, because as I'm increasingly seeing, the same banking gentlemen are pulling the strings from one regime to the next. And when they don't like one ruler, they are organising the bubble bursting, which brings the disaffection, which allows the next chapter to come along. And he has to swear an oath of allegiance to the people when he's crowned, the next guy each time in the 17th century, but he's already behind the scenes pledged his loyalty to the gentlemen who hold the purse strings.
What about Britain's role today, though? Do you think we still have one, or is that long gone with the empire?
I'm so cynical now, I would like to think, Tony, that we should just quietly restrict ourselves to sorting out the massive problems within our own island. I think the Americans are increasingly feeling the same. They don't want to police the world anymore. But we cannot escape the mantle that's been cast over our shoulders of moral inspiration for the rest of the world. A surprising number of people watching UK Column, and I'm sure listening to you as well from overseas, get in touch with us and say, we still respect the British. We still think there's something special about you. And we still look to you for a moral and intellectual lead. And for a certain way of doing things, which, you know, to this day, even here on the in the continent, very close to Britain, in a civilized country like the Netherlands, we're still seen as gentler, more refined, more humane than many of the other countries in the world. We even had an Egyptian Muslim talk to Brian Gerrish once and say, you know that if you can defeat tyranny in Britain, I'm sure that it can be defeated in the whole world. You are the key. And he's by no means the only one we've had in this regard. So I think reluctantly I've come to accept that we do still have a symbolic role around the world. Our actions are somehow magnified in the telling and in the viewing internationally. And, you know, people are still watching what we do.
Also, Zionism started here. I mean, people can look at the Brits and say, well, you created America, which has turned into now a monster for many countries around the world, and Israel too. And you allowed, the British allowed the Zionists to create this state on what was part of the Palestinian mandate after the Treaty of Versailles. And that has also caused a lot of problems. So what's your view on now how that is all playing out? Because we're now in the situation, I mean, you talk about yourself as a committed Christian, where Christian patriarchs in Jerusalem, even just this week, have been saying help, basically, because Christianity in Jerusalem is being squashed.
Yes, this is a great grief to me, and I have to say also a growing number of Christians, the unquestioning and very enthusiastic support for political secular Zionism, as I should properly call it. Increasingly in least recent decades, it is taking on the robe of religious Judaism, but it was very sharply defined in the early years of political Zionism in Israel itself. This is the 40s and 50s, that to be a Zionist was almost a contradiction in terms from being a religious Jew. It was very close in understanding to being a Marxist, to be a Zionist in those days. But now that there is this religious dressed-up version of Zionism afoot, it has proven possible to bring a lot of British, American, Australian, and other mostly Protestant Christians along with the movement. It's mostly out of an illiteracy about the Bible that this has been caused. You know, a lot of people, not just the dispensationalist tradition of evangelicalism, but other kinds of serious Bible readers.
This is,
have never really got
hang
to
on,
grips
this dispensational
with
thing is people who talk about the rapture. So it seems, yes, a little bit cheeky, really, to say, well, when things get tough on planet Earth, all the Christians are just going to be given a kind of get out free card. And I don't know if there really is any kind of biblical evidence for that. And yet some groups in historically anyway, I mean, some today still are saying that this is there written in black and white in the Bible.
Yes, well, it's the Scofield Reference Bible and the theology also of John Nelson Darby, the founder of the Plymouth Brethren in 19th century Dublin, although he was an aristocratic Englishman, of course. This is where the thinking comes from. And well, I don't have many firm data points on it. I'm increasingly of the view that ultimately the deep state in its guise of Church of England was steering this as a reaction to popular middle-class well-informed evangelicalism of the early 19th century. You know, there's the evangelicalism of William Wilberforce, for example, which was not just anti-slavery, but good in many other ways for society, calling people to be moral and inquisitive and integral. As a response to that, the deep state in one of its many hats it wears, which is the Church of England, as an institution, I mean, as an archiepiscopal institution, not the masses of Anglicans, decided that it needed to infiltrate these bodies, the Simeonites and the other forms of earnest early Victorian evangelicalism. And one of the outcomes of that process is, I think, dispensationalism on both sides of the Atlantic. Another of the outcomes is Pentecostalism. A chap called Chaitkin, C-H-A-I-T-K-I-N, describes this very well. Again, he's a member, or was in the 90s, I think still is, of the Lyndon LaRouche political organization. Again, they are of a particular persuasion, very anti-British, anti-monarchical left-wing Americans, but they do have solid arguments. They have seen a lot of what's gone wrong in different forms of the crown and its power. And I think they're correct to say that all these forms of hot Protestantism that go into ideas of the rapture, dispensation, and so on, are actually deliberately crafted that way by, as I say, High Anglicans, and also to some extent by Jesuits. The whole theological framework of futurism, which is a more general term than the rapture, now the idea that the revelation is all going to be fulfilled in the future, is itself starts in the Reformation era as a Jesuit response. Well, of course, the Jesuits don't come along till very close before the Reformation, but shall we say a Vatican response to Protestantism is to impose this idea that Revelation is all for the future and we must look for certain political events to be fulfilled. It was not the conviction of the church or of the church's scholars for over 1,000 years before that. In all that period, the main interpretation of New Testament prophecy had been preterist or historicist. In other words, that the prophecies have largely been fulfilled or are being fulfilled in our day, which is a far more sensible, Irenic way of looking at the Bible, which doesn't lead to this kind of support for political Zionism and other wacky projects.
Well, what about, say, the Second Coming? Because, I mean, it seems pretty obvious that that hasn't happened yet.
Correct, but Scripture has more than one fulfillment each time. There are primary fulfillments and different chronological fulfillments. The parousia, the Second Coming of Christ, is clearly at the end of time and is described as such in both Testaments and in the Gospels, particularly Matthew 24. But there is also a visitation of Christ in terms of visiting Jerusalem and the Jewish nation and the church for their sins. That has really been described by many people as having, in its first sense, happened in AD 70, when the Jewish nation is removed from the land, the temple service and Second Temple Judaism is put to an end completely. That is, to many serious Bible students, the first fulfillment of Matthew 24 and the passages in Revelation.
Now, this stuff is getting very current, isn't it? Because we've just had the moving of the US embassy into Jerusalem, apparently against international law because of the UN's decisions on the borders of Israel, and also a photograph just this week or last week of the US ambassador to Israel with a big picture of the third temple, that is to say a Jewish temple built, and no sign of the Dome of the Rock, which is the big Islamic temple which has been there for many years on the site of the third temple, which obviously that would be an immense provocation if what was painted in that picture was actually allowed to happen. It does seem that the Zionists do want to take back control of Temple Mount and to rebuild the third temple. So what do you make of these attempts by the Netanyahu and Likud party, particularly, kind of patted on the back, really, by Donald Trump?
Yes, well, they realise time is short, I think, to fulfil their agenda. Netanyahu, personally, I regard as a crook, and even those of my friends who are as friendly towards the Jews as I am, other committed Christians of that persuasion, have no hesitation in saying that Bibi Netanyahu has got some extremely serious questions to answer. He's even fallen out with Soros, which takes some doing. Netanyahu has been doing some very dirty deals behind the scenes, which are coming out now in the Knesset and in Germany as well, with regard to armament sales with Germany, getting the Dolphin class of submarines, some of the sneakiest nuclear submarines in the world, all undeclared arsenal, of course. There's questions to answer about involvement in construction fraud. This is all well known with Netanyahu. More generally, if we talk about the political Zionists, well, yes, you can understand that those of them that are believing Jews, which is not many, I don't think, of the people who rule Israel, not really, but those of them who are believing Jews, they can, you can understand almost charitably that they do wish to see a temple built, but it necessarily entails the knocking down of the Dome of the Rock, which is pretty much the act that's going to trigger Third World War, whether or not you believe in the biblical Armageddon view of it, because, it's the most contested real estate in the world. Certainly a lot of American evangelicals, but also non-Christians like Trump, who's never really shown himself to have any kind of Christian faith that I can see, are on board with this, largely out of expediency, I think, or out of an inchoate sense that Israel is the right side to support in the Middle East.
Also, let's get back to talk a little bit about the cryptography and the signals intelligence, because one of the things which stands out as a real enigma over the last, 10 years or so, is the death of a chap called Gareth Williams. The reason I mention it is because the narrative that we've been told by the mainstream press and by the police, that actually he was supposed to have committed suicide in a holdall, find with his various body parts, had been stuffed into a holdall in his flat. What do you make of this attempt to really present the public, after the death of a GCHQ cryptographer with a version of events which just simply cannot make sense.
Well, we've seen it again with the story about Mr. Skripal, who mercifully wasn't killed. But there's a whole series of them who've had these inexplicable deaths, most of them Russian oligarchs and defectors rather than GCHQ men. But the key thing about these is that all the suspicious deaths of the Russians in this whole network of deaths, the cluster of deaths, the Russians were not pro-Putin people. They were more or less out on their ear. They jumped before they were pushed, or they were physically expelled from Russia and ended up in London and then died. People might be surprised to hear me recommending BuzzFeed News, but there's a very, very good six-parter, and the journalist who wrote it got some very nasty hassle while she was writing it, so I think she's onto something, about the deaths of the whole series of gentlemen in question, including Gareth Williams. We have, as one of our supporters at UK Column News, a lady called Michelle Young, who is the widow of Scott Young, Scott with a single T, a Dundonian hard-nosed financial advisor who found himself thrown out of a window and basically suicided as one of these deaths. They all seem to tie back to Berezovsky in the end, who basically was not so much being steered by MI6, as far as I can see now, but was steering MI6 and in turn was some kind of Rothschild frontman to do so. With this crazed anti-Putin attitude that Berezovsky had. And then, of course, Berezovsky himself gets bumped off. And this is dressed up as a suicide. And Pata Katsishvili, the Georgian oligarch in the series, has a heart attack. I was still at GCHQ at that time, and I remember the total shock that this could happen right under our noses. Really, these whole cluster of deaths, it is hard to put your finger on exactly what's going on. There's also been the claim by a researcher called Gordon Bowden, Bowden, and he's got some good material to back this up, that Gareth Williams is more to do with the cluster of claims around Andrea Davison, who says that she was MI5 in the past and who knew a lot about the elite covering up of child abuse and the use of child abuse as a control mechanism. She's now in Latin America having skipped bail. But she is from the same part of North Wales as Gareth Williams was from, and she claims, not entirely to my satisfaction, I have to say, I don't think the dates match, but she claims she knew him when he was on loan to MI6. Well, I certainly knew him in the corridors. I knew him to look at GCHQ before that posting to MI6 when he died. I don't want to be definitive about what's happened here, but I think that if you look at the whole cluster of these deaths, I forget the lady's surname right now, but Heidi, someone wrote this six-parter on BuzzFeed News, you'll find from 2015, I think it is. Then, and there's a good infographic to trace all the deaths chronologically and by theme as well. What you come down to is what bound all these people together is that they knew rather too much about financial and cabal lines of control into the British government, and perhaps knew too much about the techniques of bogus claims that the Russians were responsible for everything.
What can folk do, do you think, Alex?
What we really need is much more of a small army than we currently have of people making the news for themselves. I don't say that they should all come to UK Column News. It would be wonderful if lots of quality people did. But people within the geographical and specialism areas that they already are in should club together with those of like mind and start reporting the news for themselves and to start talking as well. Discussion clubs, which at times of awaking from tyranny, have always been very important. Get together with people of different walks of life, but who share your concerns. Work out what you think the narrative is, what actually is happening. Then talk about it. And if your efforts are successful, then you'll soon be noticed, and you can affiliate with other such clubs. Diversify the sources of news that you're following, really, and start feeding things of concern through to the alternative media, which is really the only hope of reporting things accurately.
Alex Thompson, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's all for this week, Dial X Bristol's first weekly podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Also, you can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, Alex Thompson from UK Column, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dial X, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us at the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.com. prsc.org.uk, and you can talk to the PRSC office on 0117 909 6897 or the China Shop on 944 4540. Volunteer with us if you like, or the hundreds of opportunities across Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 to 8pm. But meanwhile, thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
'Cause I'm free.